This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Monday the 22nd of January. Welcome to your nightly news and current affairs show, The Informer. I'm your host, Lara Dickinson. On tonight's show, we head to Victoria as free hepatitis A vaccinations are being offered to men who have sex with men from today after a number of outbreaks of the viral liver disease. We touch base with the chair and co-chair of Midsummer and the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras festivals, who are starting to work together to build greater pathways for our community. We see if this is something that can travel beyond the two big festivals to help support the smaller LGBTQI festivals around the nation. And in the wake of Perth trans sex worker CJ Palmer being found guilty over allegedly infecting a client with HIV, we ask the question, if you equals you, undetectable equals untransmissible, why is this a message that the greater community are not aware of?
This is The Informer, Joy's nightly news and current affairs program. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS us on 0427 Joy 949, email on air at joy.org.au or add us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
With a number of outbreaks of the viral liver disease hepatitis A, men who have sex with men around Victoria are eligible for a free vaccination as of this week. While hepatitis A symptoms last for weeks or months and generally cause no long-term liver damage, anyone interested in protecting themselves can ask their doctor for a vaccine or go to a sexual health clinic. Dean Arcuri speaks to Melanie Eagle, the CEO of Hepatitis Victoria, about the hepatitis A outbreak and how you can get vaccinated and what you need to look for in case you're infected.
With 27 cases of hepatitis A recently being confirmed in Victoria and more under investigation, we spoke to Melanie Eagle, the CEO of Hepatitis Victoria, about why this hepatitis A outbreak is such a concern and how this differs from hepatitis B and C.
And it's a great opportunity to clarify something that's often quite confusing for people. They're all forms of viral hepatitis, meaning they're as a result of a virus, and they affect the liver. But they're quite different in that hepatitis A isn't chronic, so it doesn't go on to be an ongoing problem for the liver. It's only ever experienced as acute, and it then ends for the person. The symptoms go away, and they can't actually get it back. It's also different in that you can have a vaccination in relation to it, and then there's no curative treatment. You just kind of, if you do happen to get it, you manage the symptoms. B and C are really the ones that are of a significant health burden for Australia and the world. They're much more common. So we get actually each year 10 times as many notifications of hepatitis B and in addition of hepatitis C as we do of hepatitis A. And the problem is that they can be long-term chronic conditions that lead to serious liver disease, cirrhosis and liver cancer. And then they do vary even amongst themselves because there is a vaccine for hepatitis B but no cure. And for hepatitis C, there's no vaccine, but there is a cure. And people might have heard a bit about that recently, and that's fantastic. It's just been in Victoria that it's been noticed that there's been a larger than usual number of instances identified. Confirmed numbers as of the data I had on Friday were 30-odd cases and I think 11 suspected. The size, and usually over the course of a year in Australia, there's 600 cases. So this is, a cluster, yes, in Victoria.
With symptoms including nausea and vomiting, you may not know that you have hepatitis A straight away. We asked Eagle about the symptoms of Hep A and how it's transmitted.
They can vary. They can be mild or severe, but they're largely around fever, so nausea and vomiting, increased temperature, sweating, and muscle and joint aches. Other ones can be loss of appetite or diarrhea or certainly jaundice, but something that people might associate with hepatitis generally, so the yellowing of the skin and the eyes. It's the fecal-oral route is how hepatitis A is essentially transmitted, and that can be contrasted with B and C, which is, you know, through the blood and sometimes through sexual fluids. So hepatitis A usually involves ingesting foodstuffs that have got, you know, fecal contamination. And so if you might remember the past berry outbreak that was a couple of years ago, and berries that had been washed in water that was contaminated by feces, for example. And that's why it's usually more common in situations where there's very poor sanitation, and so it's often in overseas countries that people actually contract hepatitis A.
Free vaccines for men who have sex with men in Victoria are available from Monday the 22nd of January, allowing protection from hepatitis A.
Great news. The Victorian government has made the vaccine free for men who have sex with men and for people who have injected in the last 12 months. What we're urging is that people make contact with their GP or their, you know, sexual health service provider and discuss whether it's appropriate for them to have the vaccine, because now's the time that it'll be available over the course of this year. And it's a course of two doses, so best to act on it quickly.
The time between having the first dose of hepatitis A vaccine and the second is 6 months, which is why getting the first vaccination now, earlier in the year, is a smarter way to go.
Symptoms might take 14 to 28 days before you experience the symptoms after contracting them. And another relevant timing issue is that after you've had the vaccine, your immunity to contracting it can vary, but it can, you know, be about a month before you're immune, and that just depends on particular individual responses.
But it does beg the question, if hepatitis A is transferred predominantly orally by fecal matter on foodstuffs, why is the vaccine only available for Victorian men who have sex with men and injection drug users?
I don't know that why it happened amongst the, you know, particular more narrow cohort is understood, but it's a fact. It's just whenever all viral hepatitis are notifiable diseases, so when a healthcare professional becomes aware of it, a pathology service or a doctor, they have to notify the Department of Health. And when there's a cluster, such as here, or an outbreak, they'll then conduct an investigation to try to understand more about it so they can manage the risk of it spreading. In doing that investigation, they have just found that they happen to be the particular groups that have been affected. So they're not saying there's a particular unusual transmission route. And it's actually across Victoria. It's not centred in, you know, a particular location, which you might think could happen at some times. It just doesn't happen to be in this situation. So they're just notified by going back and doing what they call contact tracing, that they talk to the people who've reported, find out some of the characteristics and that what they found out, and so they're using that as an opportunity to target the response and make the vaccine free. People make contact with their GP or their, you know, sexual health service provider and discuss whether it's appropriate for them to have the vaccine, because now's the time that it'll be available. We're really encouraging people to do that and make use of this opportunity.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
For the last 35 years, men have been told one thing, to wear a condom. But now there are other forms of protection that do not involve latex barriers, and they are a healing community divided by decades of destruction. In 2018, HIV-negative people are confidently having sex with HIV-positive people without condoms and without fear of contracting HIV. These days, having sex with someone who is HIV-positive on daily treatment and undetectable is some of the safest sex you can have. Dean Arcuri spoke to Craig Burnett, who is living with HIV, and David Kernahan, the CEO of the WA AIDS Council, asking if the scientific evidence is clear that someone living with HIV, which is undetectable, does not pose an infection risk to the sexual partners, why are we not getting this message?
Yeah, so U equal U is the concept that if a person living with HIV has an undetectable viral load, that they are not really capable of transmitting the virus from them to somebody else, even if they have condomless sex. When I was first diagnosed, it was quite a big shock for me because I had followed all the precautions of always using a condom for penetrative sex. And so to get the diagnosis that I was positive was quite shocking to me. But condoms aren't 100% effective, and you know, sometimes they break and sometimes you don't notice, and these kind of accidents happen. And so even though you can be as vigilant as you like with these kind of situations, sometimes everything just works against you. So after I was diagnosed, the doctors said that it looked like that I had had HIV for a few years. They couldn't, like, tell me exactly when, but they said about 2 or 3 years. I had a low CD4 count and a high viral load count. But they said, we're not going to start treatment right away. We're going to take a couple of months of observations to see how you're trajectorying. And then we'll talk about treatment. And then I think after about 6 months, they put me on treatment and said, here's 2 pills to take once a day. And we'll keep seeing you every 3 months for the next little bit, just to make sure that everything's going okay. When I was diagnosed, I knew that death was not imminent for me, even if I was to not treat it. It would still take quite a long time before anything went incredibly bad. So I guess for me, I didn't have a huge amount of anxiety health-wise. But, you know, after I was diagnosed, I didn't really have any kind of intimacy with anyone for a good 6 months or so, because I just felt like this ticking time bomb. And I was diagnosed 10 years ago, and even after treatment I still felt that way because no one was saying that it didn't make me less infectious.
But are we more aware of what U equal U actually means?
I think generally speaking there is more awareness. I still find more often than not I'm having to still educate people. It's just the way that things are. I think HIV is a really scary topic for people to think about. It's quite confronting. We've had a lot of scare tactics in the past that people haven't really let go of. And so a lot of people just choose not to educate themselves because they're going to have to think about it in a very confronting way, and it's very uncomfortable for them. I even think that sometimes, not always, like, I'll hook up with someone who's on PrEP, and even then they have to do, like, a mental arithmetic to be like, I'm on PrEP, you're undetectable, okay, all of that computes, yes, it's fine, which is good that they're thinking about it, but at the same time, it's still obvious that fear is underlying.
We spoke to David Kernahan, the CEO of the W AIDS Council, about how they're getting the message of U equals U out there and if he feels it's really making the impact we need it to make.
It's really trying to sort of use the social media platforms that we have in terms of Facebook, advertising through Out in Perth, and just getting some awareness within the community about what the campaign actually means. I don't think it's really gained a lot of traction here yet. Some people understand it, but a lot within the community, I would say, don't. There is that sort of almost sort of sense of freeze, that sort of, oh, I don't want to deal with it. I'm not sure that people actually understand what undetectable means, in the sense that some people think, oh, that means you're cured, and which then is another whole discussion. So it's really about, you know, getting that message out amongst people that undetectable means that it's the viral load is undetectable rather than a cure as such. We all have good intentions about practicing safe sex and being responsible and all the rest of it, but then come Friday night, you know, we've had a few drinks or whatever it is, and those intentions tend to get sidetracked. And so the message, trying to get the message out to people within the community for who that's a reality, becomes another whole challenge. And I think as men we often have a lot of fear, and it's easier not to know. It isn't just about providing, it is about providing education for the community as a whole, but it's also about trying to provide information that specifically targets men and how men actually absorb information. Those men that, you know, do take responsibility for their sexual health, learn about what U equals U means. But equally, there are many men that just don't want to know. It's easier. You know, I don't want to know. Don't tell me. Then I don't have to deal with it. And it's about how we message to those men, because those men are most at risk, not only for themselves, but for their sexual partners as well.
Understanding the science is one thing, but as we've discovered, it's a very different kettle of fish when it's going on in the bedroom. As Craig Burnett continues to share with us.
I think people know it, but they don't believe it. And we've had such a stigma about being HIV positive for such a long time that when someone says to you, you know, there is a chance that you could get it, everything goes out of the window. And when people start having an emotional response to something like that, studies and statistics and evidence isn't the way that you're going to get people to listen or understand, because that's logic and reason trying to deal with emotion, and they don't really solve each other. But I think what is important is for people living with HIV to express that the reason that they are on treatment and prevention is to take care of other people as well as taking care of themselves. The idea that, you know, you may think that I'm, you know, untrustworthy, or you don't want to trust what I'm saying because you think that all I want to do is get in your pants. But the reality is that I've done a lot of thinking within myself to say, hey, I'm doing this to protect my community and my fellow people. And so that is why treatment as prevention is really helpful.
There is still more to come on Joy's The Informer, the news program from an LGBTI perspective.
Summer doesn't just mean it's really hot, it also means the beginning of the LGBTIQ festivals for the year. We've got Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras gearing up for a huge 40th celebration. Taz Pride just finished this past weekend, and Midsummer kicked off a week ago with 22 days of queer arts and culture taking over Melbourne. There's a whole lot of queer fun all over the nation. At the opening of the Midsummer Carnival last weekend, the Midsummer Chair John Caldwell and Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras co-chair Kate Wickett met up to talk about how they can share ideas, themes and experiences as a way to influence the direction of Australia's two biggest LGBTIQ festivals.
It's really about understanding that while in different cities we have unique and different experiences, the LGBTI community often experience same and similar forms of discrimination, but also experience similar issues with the community and different parties and events. So it's really about the Pride organisations coming together and sharing information about how we are going to maintain our relevance as Pride organisations, understand what our vision and goals are in terms of the balance between advocacy organisations and I suppose entertainment or party organisations. That's something that's come up a lot over the last several years, and certainly something that we grappled with when I was on the board of Midsummer. How do we best serve and best reflect our community when there are other LGBT organisations in advocacy roles, and do we purely become a festival or a performing arts or a party organisation for the community? I attended the Darwin Pride Festival last year, and it has changed significantly since the first time I attended it some 15 years ago. So I think, as I said, there's a real momentum and a real coordination and cohesion within the Pride groups themselves. It's now about taking it to the next step and sharing that information cross-border and seeing how we can't, I suppose, you know, whether it be more efficiency or economies of scale and sharing learnings with sponsorships or with community organisations, opening that dialogue cross-border, I think, is going to be crucial. I think another thing to note is that Therese Cashew, who is our CEO at Mardi Gras, is also has a great working relationship with Karen at Midsummer. Again, it's about sharing ideas, sharing opportunities, sharing problems and challenges that we face, given that they're not completely unique despite the difference. cities. And I think the same could be said of, you know, Brisbane or Adelaide with feasts. It's a real time to come together, particularly after such a big year last year with marriage equality, is to really harness and keep the momentum between bringing the community together. I mean, the experience that we had last year was highly traumatic for a number of people, but also highly inspirational for a number of people, because we did as a community really pull together in a way that we hadn't or haven't before.
We've had a quite a good relationship since I joined the board of Midsummer. It's a journey, and it's a slow one, because we're both quite big organisations with obviously our own agendas that need to be pushed through. I think what we're really trying to work towards at the moment is a common understanding of what we're both needing, leveraging that where we can, initially in support, obviously just by being together, by utilising each other's, whether it's media or crowd capacities to help the other. But ongoing, I see it could become a lot deeper than that. There might be synergies within our organisation where we can leverage resources and time. There's a lot of things we can do, but I think the beginning of this is to make sure that as two organisations, as representatives of our community that are facing the same challenges, it would be unquestionable to think we don't stand together at this point and try and work as a team on things. Obviously, Mardi Gras and Midsummer are the two larger ones, and I think if we can certainly be seen to be united, there's absolutely no reason why others can't unite with us or with each other. Those smaller festivals with even smaller resources, why on earth wouldn't we be helping each other, supporting each other, be that in advice or resources? I know that our CEO has a relationship with almost all of the other festivals. We are the biggest and busiest, but we're certainly here if they need anything. And I think we're very open to providing assistance if somebody needs something from us. I've spoken publicly, I guess slightly embarrassed, that I didn't really know too much about the depth of Midsummer before joining the board. But to see the arts and culture side of it, and to understand that more, and to watch that growing, I mean, I'm inspired by it, and to watch it growing in the diverse way that it is, with representation from Indigenous communities, trans community, from people with disability, non-English speaking backgrounds, it really inspires me. And I watching all different types of our community coming together to put on this festival, you know, 170 events this year. It's just astounding to me. And the true diversity of these brave people putting themselves out there to tell their stories to help us all, it can only get bigger and better.
But what about the other LGBTIQ festivals around the country? Sure, Feast, Taz Pride and many more don't have the same resources to draw on like Melbourne and Sydney's festivals, but that doesn't mean their contribution to our culture is any less vibrant or important. Could all of Australia's LGBTIQ festivals come together again, as they did in the past, as a way to share experiences and ideas which would then grow our state's festival cultures all around the nation? We spoke to Feast producer Margie Bishop and asked her if she thought this would be helpful or even something that's possible.
Well, I'm one of the founders of Feast, and then I was the artistic director for 7 years. The concept is great, and I've done it before. The only, it's better for Midsummer and Mardi Gras because they're so close together, but there's masses of potential for all sorts of things. So, yes, I'm right into it. As a concept, it's a great idea. When we used to get together before with the festivals, we talked more about the problems we had as festivals and kind of how it was going artistically. But, I mean, look, loads of positive things are possible. Anybody who's an artist is not really keen on chairs of boards being the only people that are involved, because I don't believe, unless the chair of a board is an artist, they actually understand anything. But I'd be more interested, if this was going to happen, having the producer or the artistic director and the chair. I just don't believe chairs understand artists. They understand how to keep something afloat. But the reason that you have an artistic director or a producer is they're actually making the connections and they're actually getting the sponsorship. I mean, that's how it is at sea. So I think it should be both.
That was Dean R. Curie talking to the chairs of Midsummer and the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras about what they could achieve by coming together and how this could help other smaller queer festivals around the nation, as festival season is officially underway and there are plenty of parties and celebrations to attend.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
That's it for another episode of The Informer, bringing you the news and current affairs for Australia's LGBTI communities. A podcast of tonight's Informer will be available to download soon at joy.org.au or on your preferred podcast platforms. Don't forget to follow us on social media, at The Informer on Joy on Facebook and at The Informer Joy on Twitter. If you have a story or tip that you'd like to share with us, get in touch at theinformer.joy.org.au. You've been listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9. I'm Lara Dickinson. Up next is Outtakes.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.